Welcome to the Smart Energy Channel at poddeck.net. I'm your host, Marco Gerritsen. Do you remember the media and political attention given to hydrogen several years ago, the hydrogen highway? Now the media and NGOs, government agencies and energy companies all seem to have turned to ethanol. Is, as many publications claim, corn ethanol or cellulosic ethanol indeed the silver bullet? The silver bullet that will give us energy security, that will lower carbon emissions and will reduce gasoline-related health problems? Or is the current attention given to ethanol mostly politically and economically motivated? We will have various podcasts about ethanol to help understand this alternative energy better. First, an interview with Professor Ted Patzak from Berkeley, who sees several major problems with ethanol, and I think he has some good points. Before we herald ethanol as the next solution, we should really carefully look at the effects of large-scale production of biomass crops on water and effects on food security, land use, carbon emissions, and of course our environment. This interview was taped in October 2006. There's been a lot of hype in the media recently about biomass and how biofuels generated from corn, for example, or cellulosic material could potentially make a difference in our energy future. And today I just want to talk to you a little bit about whether or not that is indeed the case and what your views are on this standpoint. So my first question really is, looking at biomass energy, do you think in the near and long-term future it will be able to make a difference in our energy consumption and production?
When you say our, you mean the United States of America. And the answer is perhaps most likely not. In fact, almost certainly not. The reason is that we use so much energy per year in this country that the plants cannot sequester enough energy even if we use the entire area of our country. And so, therefore, our supply is limited.
So how do you you're making a statement here that we cannot produce enough and that we would have to pave the whole of the United States with biomass. But at the same time, the USDA and other organizations have published reports that said that it will be doable. So can you just point out where they go wrong and why their numbers are not correct?
Well, this USDA/DOE report of 1.3 billion tons of dry biomass per year without much rearrangement of agriculture and anything else is, in fact, in my mind, one of the more anti-scientific documents published in recent memory. It is based on assumptions which clearly cannot be realized in practice, such as increasing efficiencies or yields of all crops in the United States by 50%, collecting 75% of everything else from the fields all the time, converting all manure that is produced on our farms other than the amount prescribed by EPA to put back on the fields into biofuels. In short, things that cannot be done. And in fact, even with these assumptions, it still remains very questionable that we could do it for more than 1 year.
So why do you think that, for example, we won't be able to increase the yield by as much as they're predicting? I mean, what is your reason for believing that they're overly optimistic?
Well, if you look at yields of engineered systems, such as crop systems and natural ecosystems, they're actually not very high. And if you look at the single most dominating plant in the United States, which is corn, which produces more energy than all other crops combined in the United States. So corn produces about 5 exajoules, and 1 exajoule is enough energy to feed the entire population of the United States for 1 year. So corn produces 5 exajoules, all the remaining crops produce about 4 exajoules of energy in grain. If you look at the energy in other parts of plants, you know, the stems, leaves, that's another 6 exajoules. And if you look at roots, perhaps 3 exajoules for the crops. Then you can go to the forests and lumber plantations, and you add to all of this another perhaps 30-some exajoules in net productivity, that is annual incremental mass production in all ecosystems. According to this USDA/DOE report, you need about 22 exajoules of primary energy to satisfy the needs outlined in the report. Well, if you compare that need with what the fields and pastures and rangeland and forests can produce in the United States, you will see that at the DOE stated efficiency, you would have to use all crops in the United States, all above mass, above ground biomass, all pasture land, all rangeland, and that is at an efficiency, energy efficiency conversion of 52%, which is huge. If you just use the current energy efficiency of corn ethanol, you're going to have to basically go to 60-70% of all forests in the United States. Of course, that's not doable. So we know already that what they propose is physically impossible.
But let's go back to Brazil, because that's the country that's always put forward as the big example here for very good energy coming from ethanol. And now we know that it is subsidized or was subsidized by the Brazilian government. We don't actually know all that much. We don't have that much data about health consequences or other consequences. But can you just give a few arguments against using Brazil as the big example and say, hey, we could actually do similar things here?
Well, I surely can. Brazil is a developing country which uses a tiny amount of energy compared to us. In fact, Brazil uses 10 times less petroleum per year than the United States. Most of fuel in Brazil is not gasoline, it's in fact diesel fuel. And that's gasoline is in Brazil less than half of the fuel they use. And then ethanol in Brazil, for the small quantity, would satisfy 40% of the gasoline use. But if you translate it into general energy use for as transportation fuels, it's less than 8% in Brazil. There is another problem. Brazilian sugarcane, in fact, is much more efficient as an energy source than corn. That there's no denying here. It has been grown in the semi-arid southwest Cerrado region, majority of it, also at the poor northeast Cerrado region. It is subject to constant irrigation, and therefore it uses enormous amount of water that people need, and the sugarcane harvest and the ethanol campaigns are usually run in the summer and fall, where the water levels are the lowest. So in fact, Brazil is running out of water as we're speaking. In addition, sugarcane has displaced pastures and other crops away from the Cerrado and in fact into the Amazon forest. People make arguments that sugarcane is no longer responsible for the deforestation, and on the surface of it, they're correct. The first displacement occurred in the 80s, and some people I talked to in Brazil estimate that for every hectare of corn, of sugarcane field, there were 5 hectares of deforested Brazilian tropical forest for pastures mostly. Right now, the story is different. It's the soybeans that enter the tropical forest in a very big way, and it's a new government program by President Lula, who wants to now establish soybeans as the source of biodiesel, which is much more important to Brazil than gasoline. And these soybeans are actually being grown in the middle of the Amazon forest or at the juncture between the Amazon forest and the savanna. And now we are talking about truly monumental deforestation of the tropical forest in Brazil. And if you look at the CO2 emissions from deforestation of tropical forest, just by burning it and exposing the soil or in some places the peat and oxidizing it, you will notice that these emissions are comparable to the entire emissions of the United States. So you're talking about billions of tons of CO2 per year emitted from tropical forest. And of course, the most emitting forests are in Borneo and in Java and in Sumatra and Indonesia, because they have very thick peat layers. A lot of forest in Brazil actually grows on mineral soil, so emissions will be less. But It's just like with the old saying, why do you rob the banks? Because that's where the money is. Well, if you want to go for biomass as a major source of energy for humanity, you have to go to the tropics. You have to destroy the tropical forest. And in the process of doing so, you will release more carbon than the entire humanity is using per year. That's entire humanity, all people on the earth. So if somebody is telling you that we are having a dramatic decrease of carbon emissions because of biofuels, think twice, and also think about it that once these forests are gone, they are gone forever. There will be irreversible changes of climate. There will be development of arid or semi-desert areas in the tropics. And just like we have decimated and depopulated forests in the old Mediterranean, in the antiquity, we will destroy these tropical forests now, and there will be nothing else left for the humanity. This is it.
Okay, that brings me actually to a related issue, is that, as you know, the European Union has recently decided that 5% of their fuel needs to come from biomass. And now they can't produce that in Europe, or they're not producing that in Europe right now. So one of the things is they're getting it from palm oil. And palm oil, of course, comes mostly now from Indonesia, Borneo. And they're cutting down the rainforest there to make room for palm oil factories. So do you have any comments on that? What do you think of that development? You know, this also leads into a question on why is biomass still seen by politicians, you know, actively in the European Union as well as in the United States as the way forward for us right now?
Well, I cannot speak for the politicians because I'm not one and I probably cannot understand the logic. But I can speak for the logic behind the European move. I think it's one of the more devastating misconceptions in environmental history that, for example, Sweden and other countries in Europe will be importing both ethanol from Brazil and from other countries, from the Caribbean countries, as well as soybeans to feed the animals, and also biodiesel from these countries. Now, you must realize that in order to satisfy the growing needs for diesel fuel in Europe, there would have to be new plantations established on the areas of the order of 1 million hectares each, okay? And there will be several of them. Now, these are areas comparable to many European countries, and they will be all destroyed forest. Now, the problem with soybean plantations on poor soil in Brazil is that they may not last that long. In fact, they may last not long at all because of the soil conditions and desertification. And so basically we are exchanging our good feelings about doing something good for the world for total destruction of the environment in places we never see and never think about. And the politicians are in fact very good in using this dichotomy between what we know and what we want and are feeding these, I would say, pleasant lies to the people who are more than ready to believe them and are saying, well, we're going to give you clean fuel. You go ahead and burn it as there were no tomorrow. Don't change your customs. Don't do many things you would have to do otherwise. For example, and again, I'm not trying to accuse Europeans. They've done many things more than we have. They do bike. They have smaller cars. They are much more efficient, at least twice as efficient as the U.S. economy. But on the other hand, they should not be fooling themselves that they are saving the world by employing biomass into their portfolio.
Let's go back to the greenhouse gas emissions, because this has, of course, been one of the main arguments in favor of biofuels. Now, most people seem to be aware that corn ethanol, in the current way it's being produced, is just not going to help very much. Most of the numbers show corn ethanol total emissions is still 85% or higher of the emissions that we would have right now for the same amount of gasoline from hydrocarbons. What about switchgrass? If it were possible to scale this up, this biological conversion process, what would the greenhouse gas emissions then be, disregarding right, anything related to production and destruction of the forest?
Well, if you were able to, one, continuously take 10 or 20 tons of dry biomass per acre year after year for decades, which means you would remove hundreds of tons of calcium, potassium, you would remove high tons of phosphorus and sulfur and many other elements, and of course hundreds of tons of nitrogen. And you would be putting nothing back from the artificial fertilizers. If this were possible, which it clearly isn't, then, and if you were to able to separate cellulose cleanly from the lignin, which is possible, and then digest the cellulose with very little energy into simple sugars, which you would then ferment, which seems to be rather very difficult if you don't want to spend a lot of energy in the meantime, then you actually would have significant decreases of CO2 emissions. But I just told you that in fact it is physically impossible. So you can do it for 1 year or 2 years, but remember, energy supply for humanity means you're going to do it for decades or maybe hundreds of years. And then you have to start putting things back into the ecosystems. So you have two choices. Either you will grow another hectare of switchgrass to service the hectare of switchgrass from which you take switchgrass for biofuels, or else you would have to use the old-fashioned fossil fuels, produce nitrogen fertilizer, dig up minerals from the earth and put them back. And that is a lot of energy. And therefore, these benefits will become much less.
Now, another really important argument that's being made, especially by NGOs and politicians, is that they want to do everything in their power to make the United States, in particular, energy independent, especially with the current crisis in the Middle East and tensions on the world oil market. So they say, well, even not even looking at whether or not we're getting something out in terms of GHGs and greenhouse gas emissions, or whether or not it is in fact very energy efficient, doesn't matter as long as we keep the energy production in our own backyard. So what are your thoughts on that?
That's actually an excellent question. So, and in fact, it highlights the entire silliness of our debate. So let's think about how much energy do we import from all Middle Eastern countries. And it turns out that right now, if you translate this number of barrels into energy, it's about 5 exajoules. And so, and if you look at all the energy consumed as gasoline and diesel fuel and jet fuel and bunker oil, so servicing the entire transportation system of the United States, we consume now about 33 exajoules. So a 15%, that's 1/5, a 15% increase of the efficiency of the U.S. transportation system would do away with all imports from the Middle East forever. And they would not have to be replaced with anything. It would be gone. You know what 15% efficiency means? 2 miles per gallon. Now explain this to me.
Well, I can't explain it, but I completely agree with you. So let me ask you this question. If you were the dictator in the United States and you had to decide where to go with our energy future, you know, what would your energy portfolio look like, and what would, for example, a transportation system look like in your ideal world?
What I would do, I would first recognize that the United States cannot exist as a country without transportation, and actually automobile transportation. So that's a given. People will kill to drive and will destroy the whole earth to drive. That's a given. So therefore, you have to give them their vehicles because they don't have any other options. And so what I would do, I would go immediately towards more efficient gasoline vehicles. I don't even say diesel for reasons I can explain later, that will be increasingly mixed as hybrids and going increasingly towards electrical vehicles within the next 15 to 20 years. Then this would open for me two things. I would eliminate the imports from the Middle East within a couple of years. That's really a no-brainer. It can be easily done. Then I would be able to do two things. Either I will develop nuclear power. And when I say nuclear power, I'm saying breeder reactors that would deliver electricity to these increasingly plug-in cars, which may or may not be the optimal solution. But it would also buy me time to develop solar PV technology countrywide, so that we can actually deliver some of the energy to our plug-in cars from solar cells.
Well, let's have a look. Let's have a think about the medium-term future. Now, so suppose that we all go for pluggable hybrids and increase how much we rely on electricity. Now, at the moment, electricity generation comes for a large extent from coal. Solar and wind are nowhere near making a substantial contribution. So for the sake of argument, say that takes 20 years to get it up to speed. One of the big dangers, obviously, in the next 10 years or so is coal, which is very dirty. And at the moment, actually, there are many plans for coal-fired power plants. So in the short to medium term, what should we be doing to for the electricity? Do you think we should go nuclear?
Well, I agree with you that coal is not a good fuel. On the other hand, coal is something we have plenty of, and there will be incredible pressure to put more coal-fired power plants in the United States. My personal opinion is this. If I had to choose between coal-fired power plant and nuclear power plant, I would clearly go nuclear. And again, there are many drawbacks to nuclear power, not the least of which is the profusion of fissile material that can be used by other people. But I at the same time, I have to say that the genie is out of the bottle, that many countries will be developing nuclear power for peaceful purposes, whether we want it or not. One such country will be India, in fact, and the other one will be China, and they have no other options because of their population pressures, and therefore they will not only have to develop nuclear power, but they probably will have to go to breeder reactors, so jump over the current stage of the development.
I want to go back a little bit to the ethanol issue here also. One of the things that I've certainly noticed reading papers is that there are a couple of issues that are discussed. One is how much energy contents is in the biofuels. The other one is greenhouse gas emissions. And things that are never really discussed, or very little, is logistics of setting up an ethanol network. And the other thing is water and water security. And you know, in my mind, it's always been, well, if you want to use ethanol to make America, for example, a fuel secure, then you make it water insecure. Can you comment on that? What are your thoughts on that?
Yes, this is actually a very good question. And I would add one more element to this puzzle. The last element of this puzzle is the population growth. The United States is actually a very dynamically growing country. Now, we probably will put fences around ourselves and make it a somewhat slower growing country. But as of now, the predictions that we have for the next 50 years is the population will add between 120 and 170 million people in the United States. If we just continue business as usual, which is what we seem to be doing right now, we would have to add another 25 to 30 exajoules in transportation fuels, which is three times as much as the 130 billion gallon task that was now put forward by the DOE. So you can see that population growth alone will eat everything we possibly can do with biofuels and actually will set us back.